So it's my pleasure this afternoon to introduce the Honorable Irwin Cotler. Professor Cotler is no stranger to Torrin Motion programs. In fact, he was just here a couple of weeks ago to introduce Lord Sachs. He's had a wonderful and distinguished academic and parliamentary career. He's a prominent human rights lawyer whose dedication to humanitarian causes has earned him the Order of Canada, among many other awards. He's currently serving as the opposition critic for justice and human rights. All of us will remember that when the Liberals were in power, he was the Justice Minister of Canada. He's the co-founder and chair of Interparliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism, which held its second international conference in Ottawa and brought together 250 parliamentarians and experts from 50 countries. He's launched an international coalition of leading jurists, parliamentarians, Iran activists, survivors, and genocide scholars to talk about Iran's state-sanctioned incitement to genocide, mass domestic repression, sponsorship of global terror, and nuclear armament. This afternoon, Professor Cotler is going to address us on issues relating to Israel and the UN and delegitimization. Please welcome Professor Irwin Cotler.
Thank you, Ellie, for those kind words of introduction. I do indeed feel very much at home here, and I'm delighted to be able to participate in yet another wonderful initiative of Torah in Motion under the leadership of Elliot and Jake Kelman. And I regret only that responsibilities in Ottawa yesterday evening prevented me from coming here before mid-morning this morning, but I will stay for the rest of the program because I don't come to speak to these things. I come in order to learn. As they say, Mikom Lamdahi Skalti. They brought together a wonderful program. I had occasion to hear one session this morning from Gershon Gorenberg, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the sessions this afternoon. And I'm pleased to participate in what I would call a discourse on delegitimization. And this is how I look at it, and this as part of the larger struggle for human rights, for human dignity, for international law, and for international peace. Delegitimization has effectively become a code word, a buzzword, to denote the assault on Israel's legitimacy, including even denying Israel's right to exist or denying the Jewish people's right to self-determination. And that has spawned a veritable conference industry. I can just tell you that I was last week at the United Nations General Assembly in Denver, where an ongoing theme was out of the delegitimization of Israel. Last June, in the conference in Israel, the international conference and the auspices of President Shimon Peres, a major theme was the delegitimization of Israel, and I can go on in that regard. But I want to suggest to you, and this will be the underlying theme of my remarks today, that the real issue is not so much delegitimization. The real issue is the laundering of that delegitimization, the masking of that delegitimization under the cover of law, sometimes known as lawfare. More importantly, this phenomenon is not simply prejudicial to democracies like Israel, but it ends up being prejudicial to the rule of law itself, while posing a threat to international peace and security. That's why I said when I address the issue of delegitimization, I'm doing so in the context of the combating of delegitimization as part of the larger struggle for international justice and peace. Simply put, if war is the continuation of politics by other means, as Clausewitz put it, then lawfare is the waging of war, or the war of delegitimization under the cover of law, or I would say under the cover of a series of public values or public goods, the protective cover of the United Nations, the authoritative and imprimatur of international law, the culture of human rights, the struggle against racism, where the objective at the end of the day is to posit Israel as the enemy of all that is good, as the enemy of all these public goods, and the repository of all that is evil. therefore the phenomenon of delegitimization. But despite all the attention it presently enjoys, delegitimization is not a new phenomenon. It has been with us since the founding of Israel, even since the founding of the Zionist movement. When reference was made, for example, on the occasion of the founding of Israel in reference to Zionism, that Zionism, Israel, was an original sin. It found expression in the run-up to the Six-Day War, which we may recall, and I was then a student at the Hebrew University, and I still recall the references to Israel as a congenital act of aggression, that its very existence was aggressive. And then it found its first institutional and international juridical expression in the Zionism is Racism, United Nations Zionism is Racism resolution, which the late Senator Daniel Moynihan summed up in one pithy sentence and beginning to, in effect, give expression to that phenomenon of the masking of delegitimization, when he said that the United Nations Zionism is Racism resolution gave, in his words, the abomination of anti-Semitism the appearance of international law, the appearance of international legal sanction. Interestingly enough, not long after that, when I was in the former Soviet Union, the then great Soviet dissident and human rights leader, Andrei Sakharov, who was so instrumental in the Soviet refusenik movement in defending the rights of refuseniks in the struggle for Soviet Jewry, referred also to the United Nations Zionism as Racism resolution, quoting Daniel Moynihan, that it gave anti-Semitism the appearance of international legal sanction. As it happens, we meet today at a rather important moment of reminder and reference and reminder, and an important moment in remembering the foundings of what I would call the delegitimization, lawfare, human rights, and international law configuration, because they're all related. We meet on the occasion of the 36th anniversary of the Zionism is Racism resolution, which, as I said, itself laundered delegitimization under the protective cover of the United Nations while invoking the imprimatur of international law. But 2011, this is sometimes forgotten, and I think the fact that it's forgotten tells us something about the phenomenon that I'm going to discuss. 2011 is also the 36th anniversary of what has come to be known as the international human rights revolution, of the ratification of both the international covenants on civil and political rights, economic, social, and cultural rights, which inspired the then U.S. Congressman Father Robert Drinan, a great hero of the Soviet Jewry movement, to write at the time, and I quote, "The elevation of human rights into an international juridical norm is the most dramatic development in the history of contemporary jurisprudence." And it was Father Robert Drinan who used this birth of the international human rights revolution, or this institutionalization of it with the ratification of the covenants, as an underpinning for the struggle for Soviet Jewry as a whole. Now, as a law professor and human rights lawyer at the time, I found myself witness to and involved with two parallel and intersecting universes. First, there was the universe of the human rights and legal revolution. That underpinned for us, those of us who recall it at the time, underpinned for us the struggle for Soviet Jewry. Indeed, the human rights movement was a focal point for that struggle for Soviet Jewry. And second, what was less known to us at the time was while this was the birth as well of the international human rights revolution, as I mentioned it, which began to underpin the Palestinian cause as a human rights cause, there was an obverse and darker side of that legal revolution that we were not that attentive to, which has come to be known as lawfare, and that is the use and abuse of law for delegitimization purposes. I might add parenthetically, and this was part of living in a number of universes at the time, that I was spending a good deal of time in those days in Israel, where I'd been, as I said, as a student during the Six-Day War, and there also during the Yom Kippur War, and subsequently as a visiting professor, and there also during my sabbatical in the Gulf War with the Scud missiles. I say that because friends of mine in Israel, whom I met, you know, first when I was there in 67 during the Six-Day War, then I was there during the Yom Kippur War, then I was there during the Gulf War, they said, tell us when you're coming back again, we won't be here. So as it turned out, I was there during the Hezbollah War, and my wife and I in the Israel-Gaza War were down in the south and ended up at that point, both in Sderot and in Ashkelon in bomb shelters because we happened to be there during, you know, rocket attacks. So I'm just giving you that kind of experiential sense in one way. But at the same time, unknown to most, I think, and I'm sure this audience probably doesn't know this, is that during the years 75, 76, 77, and 78, I used to spend 3 months every summer in the Arab countries. Even the word Arab is too homogenous. In Egypt, in Syria, in Jordan, in Lebanon when I could, in the Palestinian territories, and then ended up in Israel. I won't go into how that also led to my marrying my wife, an Israeli, but I'll leave that for another time. But just to give you the experiential sense in which I found myself inhabiting the different universes. But back to the particular human rights universes at the time and the delegitimization of at the time. Now, a case study of the convergence of these two universes, not now, then, even before the United Nations Zionism is Racism resolution, of the human rights legal revolution on the one hand and delegitimization and lawfare under the cover of that human rights and legal revolution on the other, and which was taking place at the same time as the United Nations Zionism is Racism resolution and went largely unacknowledged and certainly unaddressed by diaspora jury and even for the most part by the leadership of Israel, and a critical mass of delegitimization which was developing then, and the laundering of delegitimization was taking a place under the protective cover of the United Nations at the time, invoking the imprimatur of international law, the culture of human rights, and the like. Let me just give you a snapshot of what was taking place at the same time as the United Nations Zionism is Racism resolution, even before it, but went unaddressed, but which feeds into the delegitimization campaign from then to now. Israel at the time was being held out to be, and I'm going to use the United Nations specialized agencies as a case study for that. Israel was held out to be as the, quote, the enemy of trade unionism. Evidence, the alleged resolution, well, it wasn't alleged evidence. The resolution of the International Labour Organization condemning, if you alleged Israeli suppression of Palestinian workers. I'm using the word alleged. That the resolution stated it as a statement of fact. And the rest that I'm going to read out was given a statement of facts. The enemy of health. Evidence, the resolution of the World Health Organization condemning Israeli poisoning of Palestinians on the West Bank. The enemy of culture. Evidence, the resolution of UNESCO condemning Israeli desecration of historic sites in Jerusalem. The enemy of women, evidence, the resolution of the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women condemning Israeli suppression of women. The enemy of human rights, evidence, the resolution of the United Nations Human Rights Commission condemning Israeli violations of human rights. The enemy of peace, evidence, the resolution of the United Nations General Assembly condemning Israel as a non-peace-loving nation. In a word, Israel held out to be the enemy of workers, the enemy of health, the enemy of culture, the enemy of women, the enemy of human rights, and the enemy of peace was held out to be the enemy of all that was good and the repository of all that was evil. This was the forerunner of delegitimization and the ultimate in delegitimization today. The ultimate being the indictment of Israel as an apartheid state, at a time that apartheid is defined in international law as a crime against humanity, and so Israel, therefore, is a crime against humanity, and taking it one step further, the indictment of Israel in morally perverse terms as indeed not only an apartheid state, but a Nazi state. And as I wrote some 30 years ago, in a world in which human rights has emerged as a new secular religion of our time, Beryl Nadler, the best of my students, is here. He'll know that I celebrated the birth of that human rights revolution. Israel was beginning to be held out, as I mentioned, as a meta-human rights violator, as the new antichrist of our time. And so the question becomes, and you might have been thinking about it as I've been going through this, if delegitimization has always been with us, why is it only emerging now or in the last year or two as a byword and buzzword? What has changed? Is it simply a matter of plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, the more things change, the more they remain the same? How does this impact, not only in terms of how we think about human rights in Israel, but more importantly, and I will get to this, on how we act or on how we must act? Let me now organize the balance of my remarks around three themes. The first is the dynamics of delegitimization. The second will be some case studies, contemporary case studies of delegitimization as we meet today. And the third is, what then can we do about it? I know that at times during my remarks there may be a sense of pessimism or even a lament that nothing can be done, and the world hates us and the like, but I want to tell you that a lamenting of delegitimization and not doing anything about it is assuring that that delegitimization will in fact continue and that we won't be combating it. So I will at the end of my remarks try to set a set of proposals as to what indeed can be done. But let me begin with that first theme of the developing dynamics of delegitimization. There is what I would call a cluster of dynamics that underpin this critical mass of delegitimization, or more importantly, the laundering or masking of that delegitimization. And then they provide context and content for understanding this phenomenon. The first is the dynamic of globalization. We have been witnessing globalization not only in terms of media and markets and trade and technology, and globalization is sometimes even restricted to something that is akin to an economic phenomenon, but I want to suggest to you that we have been witnessing for some 35 years now the globalization of law, of human rights, of NGOs, in other words, all the constituents of the global human rights legal revolution. And those constituents also have led inexorably to lawfare. Lawfare in two senses, in the double entendre. There is a good part of lawfare, and that is the use of law and human rights for the advancement and protection of vulnerable minorities and the like. In other words, the use of law as indeed a protector of human rights, human dignity, and international peace. But at the same time, there has been, and it has found particular expression with regard to Israel, the obverse and darker side of this lawfare. And that is, if you want to spell the first one as L-A-W-F-A-I-R, and the second one L-A-W-F-A-R-E. And that is the use and abuse of law for purposes of delegitimization, and delegitimization as a globalized phenomenon. So that's the first dynamic. The second is the reconfiguration of the Arab-Israeli conflict as an Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I remember my late colleague Walter Tarnopolsky, a judge of the Ontario Court of Appeal, telling me at that time, in 1975, and his statement to me was as follows, that if the Arabs say that Israel has no right to exist, then they have no case and no standing to make the case. But if Israel says that the Palestinians have no right to a state or have no right to even be seen as a people, then they will be seen as having no case and no standing to make the case. Just the reconfiguration of the conceptualization of the conflict from the Israel-Arab conflict, where in that configuration Israel is the minority, and in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict where the Palestinians are seen as the minority. The third was the reframing, and we were missing this because this began 35 years ago with the Human Rights Revolution, the reframing of the narrative of this Israeli-Palestinian conflict in human rights terms, and the Palestinization of that human rights narrative, with the emergence of the Palestinian cause being held out as the prototype of the human rights cause, in the same way that we Jews in the diaspora were holding out the Soviet Jewry cause as the prototype for the human rights struggle. What we were not realizing, and maybe because we were overtaken with the understandable and necessary imperative of the Soviet Jewry human rights cause, what was passing under the radar screen at the same time in a parallel dynamic was the Palestinization of the global human rights revolution for Palestinian purposes. And the corollary of that was the emergence from a delegitimization phenomenon, the emergence of Israel as the antithesis of that Palestinian human rights cause, if not of the cause of human rights generally. The fourth was the mainstreaming of the human rights narrative, and you know, we've experienced as those of us who live amongst what I would call the trahison d'éclair, I'm using a term of Ernst Benda, the betrayal of the elites, but those of us who are in that world of parliaments and academics and the like, what we found is the mainstreaming of that human rights narrative and the Palestinization of that narrative amongst the elites, political, diplomatic, parliamentary, media, NGOs, intellectuals, and the like. The fifth was the end of the Cold War. And with that, the denouement, the ending of the struggle for Soviet Jewry as the leitmotif of the human rights struggle in a global sense, and the leitmotif of the relationship in East-West terms, and which partook of the international legal revolution as a whole, as I mentioned. But the globalization of the struggle for human rights continued with the end of the struggle, a part of that struggle, re-Soviet Jewry, and it was continuing and morphing into the darker side of lawfare and the subsequent delegitimization of Israel under the cover of law, which leads me to a sixth and coming to an end of these dynamics, and that is the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement as metaphor and message of that delegitimization. The politicization of academe, where this is very much centered, and the Palestinization of the campus culture, with the Palestinian cause becoming the poster child for the human rights cause, and Israel Apartheid Week becoming, as it were, an alleged manifestation of the human rights cause within the campus culture, with whatever contradictions that implies. I'm talking now about the dynamics. And finally comes Durban 1. Durban 1 in 2001 and its aftermath. This brought about the institutionalization of lawfare, the full-blown delegitimization and the launching of that delegitimization of Israel under the protective cover of the UN, the authority of international law, the culture of human rights, the struggle against racism. With the battle cry at Durban, and I can see it in my mind's eye now as somebody who was there in Durban, a transformative experience for those of us who were there and experienced that festival of a culture of hate, and hearing in the streets every day the marching with that refrain and, you know, over and over again. If the struggle against racism in the 20th century required the dismantling of South Africa as an apartheid state, then the struggle against racism now in the 21st century requires the dismantling of Israel as an apartheid state. And you had 4,000 NGOs that were there. You had a youth conference while we were there, along with the intergovernmental conference. And so the phenomenon of delegitimization of lawfare and the laundering of that delegitimization under all the good rubrics paralleled, if you will, both the emergence of the human rights and legal revolution and the morphing into delegitimization. Let me now move to my second theme and give you four case studies of this phenomenon of delegitimization. And the four case studies, very quickly, are those to which I've referenced in name, but will now give you some of the substance. Delegitimization under the protective cover of the United Nations, delegitimization under the authority of international law, delegitimization under the cover of human rights, and delegitimization under the struggle against racism. In each and every instance, the laundering of that phenomenon or dynamic of delegitimization. Let me say also that for both reasons of time but respect for this being an informed audience, I'm only going to give you highlights of each and therefore will abbreviate it. On each of these issues, you could write not only a chapter but a book. Let me begin with delegitimization under the protective cover of the UN. A dramatic case study here, and I referred earlier to what was happening in the specialized agencies of the UN, the ILO, WHO, etc. It's still happening, that which I told you began in 1975. But as we meet now, there is, and it's about to conclude for this year, the annual ritual of United Nations General Assembly resolutions. It's a three-month process. It begins in September. It ends in November. Some 20 to 22 resolutions of condemnation single out one member state of the international community. Yes, it happens to be Israel. More resolutions of condemnation against Israel than against the rest of the world combined. So you say, we know all that. You're not telling us anything new. What I just want to add to that is every day of the year, somewhere in the international community, somewhere, there is a United Nations agency, decision, resolution, initiative that is singling out Israel for differential and discriminatory treatment. And the most important part, and this is the part that I don't think we realize, you know about the part about the condemnatory resolutions, though you may not realize the extent of them. But what is parallel to that is that, and I have been a member of Canadian delegations, so I've witnessed it myself, it's not only a critical mass of delegitimization through the protective cover of the United Nations in all its manifestations. It's that there is a critical mass of people that are exposed to it. Parliamentarians, jurists, diplomats, educators, human rights people, students, journalists, NGOs, all those who are attending and partaking of this UN culture. So it isn't only, and it can't just be dismissed, shmoom. You have to realize, and I've seen it my own, that there are people who come as part of a Canadian delegation who are basically uninformed or maybe somewhat misinformed about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But if they sit there for weeks and months listening to all this, then they begin to internalize this as if it were findings of fact and conclusions of law. I say that because all these UN resolutions read exactly like that, like findings of fact and conclusions of law, like legal judgments. And if that drumbeat continues year after year, over and over again, every day, at every different United Nations agency, then you begin to see how that phenomenon can take effect. And it's not surprising that there is a focus increasingly in the last few years, though it was there before, but increasingly on the quote-unquote illegality of the settlements. It's not an accidental or fortuitous phenomenon, because we are, after all, and the West is, after all, a legal culture. We are a due process society. We take law seriously, Canada, the United States. So if you say that Israel is violating international law with its illegal settlements, that's much worse than if you say the settlements are stupid or ill-advised or bad policy or what. About those things you can have different opinions. But when you invoke the imprimatur of international law to argue that the settlements are illegal and do so in an ongoing drumbeat, then what you do is set up a situation where Israel is regarded not simply in terms of the illegality of the settlements, but in terms of the overall findings of fact and conclusions of law, as if it were an international outlaw. And this is also not fortuitous in terms of the dynamic of delegitimization and its origins and development. I still remember my meeting And I wrote about this at the time, in 1977, with Osama El-Baz, then the special advisor to Sadat, became the special advisor to President Mubarak. And his words still ring for me. And he said, you know, if Menachem Begin, this was shortly after Menachem Begin was elected Prime Minister of Israel, and he said, if Menachem Begin continues to say that if we have no right to Hebron, we have no right to Tel Aviv, then we will show the world that Israel has no right to Hebron, and then the world will realize that Israel has no right to Tel Aviv. And so it's not an accidental or fortuitous or innocent dynamic, regardless of where you stand on the issue of the policy or legality of the settlements. I'm just connecting it to the tissue of how it can be used and abused within the phenomenon of delegitimization. Let me bring you to the second case study, and that is delegitimization under the protective cover of international law. On this, as I said, a book can be written. I'm going to give you only one case study. And the one case study has to be, in that situation, the whole phenomenon that has developed with regard to the singling out of Israel, and I just want, I'm skipping a bit to go a little faster, singling out of Israel for differential and discriminatory treatment under the rubric of the principle of universal jurisdiction. Now, universal jurisdiction means very quickly, because I don't want to also abuse your sensibilities with legalese. Basically, what it says is that if there is a situation of war crimes, crimes against humanity, let alone the crime of crimes, genocide, then every state has the right to bring the perpetrators of these international crimes to justice under a principle of universal jurisdiction. These are such horrific crimes against humanity that every state is, in effect, the agent of its enforcement along with the UN. The first state to invoke the principle of universal jurisdiction was Israel in the Eichmann case. So we're now here on the 50th anniversary of the Eichmann trial. And I say this because we have to watch, when we talk about delegitimization, not to be dismissive of international law generally, not to be dismissive of the principle of universal jurisdiction generally. We used it, Israel used it, with respect to Eichmann. The real issue is when the principle of universal jurisdiction is used and abused to single out Israeli nationals for selective prosecution. That then becomes not only prejudicial to the Israeli nationals, it becomes prejudicial to international law generally. And I can go into chapter and verse of other manifestations of the prejudicial use of international law, but I want to give you an example as to how these things work out in terms of the phenomenon of the use and abuse of international law for purposes of delegitimization, which brings me to the third dynamic, a third case study, and that's the laundering of delegitimization under the cover of human rights. The dramatic case study here, and again I can give you many, I'm just using one, dramatic case study here is the work of the United Nations Human Rights Council, the successor to the previous United Nations Human Rights Commission, held out, and you have to understand, it's not how we think of these things. I'm trying to place us where the world thinks of these things, or whereas a professor of international law uses textbooks with respect to the judgments of the UN Human Rights Council, the jurisprudence of international human rights linked up to its predecessor, United Nations Commission on Human Rights. Well, the UN Human Rights Council was established, in effect, in place of the UN Human Rights Commission because that became so discredited in its singling out of Israel and human rights that even the delegitimizers were realizing they were getting embarrassed. So it was recreated under the rubric of the UN Human Rights Council, allegedly in order to bring a semblance of equality and due process. What happened? Under the first 16 resolutions of the newly created UN Human Rights Council, all 16 condemned one member state, Israel. The major human rights violators, Iran, Syria, Libya, China enjoyed exculpatory immunity. Not one resolution passed against them. And if you want to see how this is not simply prejudicial to Israel, it's that Libya was chairing the UN Human Rights Council when I appeared before it in 2005, when Libya should have been then in the docket, and maybe we could have avoided the whole atrocities with regard to the Libyan assault, etc. Syria was a member of the UN Human Rights Council when it should have been held to account. And now, as we meet today, the world is wondering, what do we do with the mass slaughter that is taking place in Syria, when we could have held them to account then rather than reward them with a seat on the UN Human Rights Council and give them immunity from any resolution of condemnation. And one final example on the human rights thing, which relates to Goldstone and the like, that I was personally involved in. It's almost the anniversary of this. Three years ago, I received a call from then Madam Justice Louise Arbour, who had been a former Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada. She was now the UN Commissioner for Human Rights. And she said to me, "Erwin, I'm calling you because I want you, I'm calling in the name of the President of the UN Human Rights Council. We want you to be a member of a two-person fact-finding committee that is going to look into the killings of Palestinians in Beit Hanun." We may forget that after attacks on Sderot, an Israeli artillery shell by way of reprisal went astray, and some 18 Palestinians were killed. So I said to her, "Is this fact-finding mission going to be going to Sderot?" And she said, "Well, why should it go to Sderot?" I said, "It's because of the ongoing attacks on Sderot, that an Israeli response went astray and some Palestinians were tragically killed." She says, "No, we're not going to Sderot, but it's a two-person fact-finding mission. Bishop Tutu is one of the members. You'll be the other, and you can give it a fair-minded approach." I said, "Louise, I've read the resolution establishing the fact-finding mission. That resolution establishing the fact-finding mission says, and I quoted from it, Israel deliberately killed women and children in Beit Hanun." So I said to her, "What is there to investigate? You've already predetermined the outcome." I said, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to be a fig leaf for this United Nations fact-finding mission. I'm certainly not going to be a Jewish fig leaf." And as I then wrote about it at the time, that was my advice to Justice Richard Goldstone. I said, "Don't take on that fact-finding mission, because you're going to be a fig leaf, indeed a Jewish fig leaf, for the UN, and you have the same terms of reference, which have already predetermined Israel's guilt before you begin on the mission." He said, no, "I have a different mandate." He didn't have a different mandate, and we all know what happened with regard to the Goldstone mission. Which brings me now to the final fourth case study, which I'll be very brief about, and that is the laundering of delegitimization under the rubric of the struggle against racism. By comparison, the United Nations Zionism is Racism resolution of 1975, in comparison with what's going on today, appears as a modest indictment. Because today, with the apartheid Nazi-like indictment, where to Israel is attributed the two great evils of the 20th century, apartheid and Nazism, you have a situation where if you accuse Israel of an apartheid state, being an apartheid state, at the time, as I said, apartheid is defined in international law as a crime against humanity. You are basically saying Israel has no right to be, a kind of prologue or justification for its dismantling. And if you add to the fact that it's a Nazi state, you're not only saying it has no right to be, what you are basically saying is that we have an obligation to ensure that it has no right to be, because a Nazi state has no legitimacy in international law. Let me move to the last part of my remarks, and I may have to take just a few minutes over from what I intended, because I don't want to leave you with the attack and the delegitimization and the laundering without some means of having and being able to respond. And so, last part, what should be done, and very quickly. Number one, we have to take back the narrative. Move out of the docket of the accused. Not so much lament this phenomenon of delegitimization or the laundering of delegitimization under the cover of law, etc., but combat it. And not, and here I want to emphasize it, not as a phenomenon that is prejudicial or simply prejudicial to Israel and the Jewish people itself. most people may not care one way or the other if it is prejudicial to Israel and the Jewish people. It's not that they're anti-Jewish or anti-Israel. It's not the world we live in. Don't assume that the world we live in is the world that the rest of Canadians live in. I can tell you that the parliamentary agenda with which I deal, 99.9% of that parliamentary agenda does not address issues related to delegitimization, Israel, and the Jewish people. But it does address issues related to the United Nations. It does address issues related to international law, human rights, the struggle against racism. Therefore, we have to make the connecting link that this phenomenon of the laundering of delegitimization is prejudicial to the protective, to the integrity of the United Nations, something that most Canadians do care about, erodes the authority of international law, something most Canadians do care about, corrupts the culture of human rights, something that most Canadians do care about, and shames the real struggle against racism, shames indeed the real struggle against the real apartheid, South African apartheid, something that many Canadians were involved with and should not want to see that kind of false slander undermine the real struggle against apartheid. So the first thing is universalize the combating of delegitimization as being prejudicial to all the things under which the delegitimizers seek to launder the delegitimization dynamic. Second, invert the Middle East paradigm, which now holds that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the source of all conflict in the Middle East, that the occupation is the source of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that apartheid Israel is the source of the occupation. Reverse it. Take back the narrative. Say that it is radical Islam and the Arab tyrannies that are the source of all conflict in the Middle East, indeed, in terms of oppressing their own people. That these same radical Islamic ideologies and Arab tyrannies effectively deny the legitimacy of the state of Israel in any borders. Indeed, they not only deny the legitimacy of a Jewish state in any borders, many of them openly call for the destruction of the state of Israel. That is the real apartheid, the denial of a Jewish state within any borders, and a criminal apartheid when you call for its destruction. Change the narrative. Change the channel on these things. The third, Iran. Don't only focus on the nuclear threat. Yes, it's a nuclear threat. It's compelling. It's a focus on the fourfold Iranian threat. You don't know what concerns people in this country. It may not be the nuclear threat. It may be the Iranian state sponsor of international terrorism. It may be the Iranian incitement, not only against the state of Israel, against the Baha'is within Iran. It may be the massive domestic assault on the human rights of their own people. So you can create coalitions with women in Canada, with religious minorities in Canada, etc., and thereby hold Ahmadinejad's Iran to account, not simply as an Iran-Israeli situation, but as Iran having emerged as a threat to international peace and security, and increasingly and alarmingly to its own people. The fourth thing, and time does not permit me to say how this can be done, just mention it. We have to restore the pain and plight of Jewish refugees from Arab countries to the international peace and justice narrative from which it's been expunged and eclipsed these last 64 years. You want one case study? November 27th will be yet again the United Nations International Commemorative Day in solidarity with the Palestinian people and Palestinian refugees. Ask the question, why not the remembrance and recognition also of the plight of Jewish refugees from Arab countries? And in effect, the Nakba, as it's called, was really the catastrophe of Palestine, was really a double Nakba. There were Jewish refugees as well as Arab refugees, which were caused by the Arab leadership and Palestinian leadership at the time. The fifth has to be with regard to the Arab Spring. We have to engage with the Arab Spring. I think if nothing else, the Arab Spring has demonstrated that in fact the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not the source of all conflict in the Middle East. The Arab tyrannies were the source of conflict and the source of repression of their own people. And it's these same Arab tyrannies who regrettably infected the Arab street with the kind of anti-Jewish and anti-Israel ethos that it had, because it's not that it came from below. It may be coming from below now, but it had been inculcated year after year for 64 years from above. Let me give you one case study that I want you to take away with in terms of acting. Right now, as I'm speaking to you, the name, how many people have heard of Michal Nabil? Exactly what I thought. Michal Nabil was one of the leaders of the Tahrir Revolution, one of the earlier spokespeople for the Egyptian Arab Spring. 26-year-old blogger who stood hand in hand as a Christian Copt with Muslims in the struggles he put at the common cause for human rights, freedom, and democracy. He said at the time, the army and the people are of one hand moving forward together. He then saw what the army was doing. He then saw the repression. He then saw the assaults and the protesters. And so he said, the army and the people are no longer of one hand. For that, he was arrested, tried, and imprisoned for insulting the Egyptian military before a sham trial of an Egyptian military tribunal. As I'm speaking to you today, it's the 90th day of his hunger strike. I was asked a week ago to take up his case by his family in Egypt and some of his family outside of Egypt, who also advised me, which I knew, that not only is Michal Nabil a Christian cop, but one of the things that did not help him initially in his case was that he called for the normalization of relations between Egypt and Israel, and he refused to join the Egyptian army because he said he didn't want to shoot Israelis. Now, here is a real hero of the Egyptian revolution in its best and authentic sense, who happened also, as part of his real commitment to democracy and freedom and human rights, to understand the Israeli cause as being a just cause. We owe at least that much to Nabil that we should not only not know about his case, but we should be acting to seek to do what we can about his case. I've already introduced a resolution in the Foreign Affairs Committee in Parliament, which unanimously called for his release. We've organized an international parliamentary campaign on his behalf, an international NGO campaign. Tomorrow I'll be meeting with the Egyptian ambassador with whom I've spoken, etc. The whole thing calling for the immediate release of Michal Nabil, both in the interests of justice, in the interests of humanity, and I would say in the self-interest of Egypt itself. Because Nabil has emerged as a litmus case of the authenticity of the Egyptian Arab Spring, of the authenticity of when they first gathered in Tahrir Square. I think we owe it to ourselves to stand there with him. Two last things, quickly. UN reform. Instead of saying shmoom, I'll give you one reform to ask of the United Nations. The UN Human Rights Council, whenever it meets, has as on every agenda, whenever it meets, item 8 says human rights violations of Israel in the Palestinian occupied territories. Item 9, human rights violations in the rest of the world. So when that UN Human Rights Council meets, and I was there, and I sat there, and I want to just mention the heroic work that is done by a former student of mine, friend, colleague of Beryl, myself, Hillel Neuer, the executive director of UN Watch, how he stands up in Geneva at the United Nations with regard to this provision and others. We have to say, with regard to the UN, it's not simply prejudicial to Israel that. It undermines the principles and procedures under which the UN Human Rights Council is supposed to operate. Equality before the law, international due process, and the like. If you single out one member state, even before the hearing begins, this is an Alice in Wonderland situation which is assaultive of the UN itself. So I close by saying the other thing I was going to do is make some reference to combating anti-Semitism. I'll only suggest to you, read the Ottawa Protocol to Combat Anti-Semitism. Reference was made by Elliot to the International Parliamentarians Conference that we had. We had 140 parliamentarians from 50 countries, mostly non-Jews. They unanimously adopted that protocol. Use that protocol. It's a template to combat anti-Semitism. It's a roadmap. It's not just rhetoric. It gives you recommendations for action. So finally, I say, delegitimization has always been with us. What is new and pernicious is the laundering of that delegitimization under the cover of all that is good and to represent Israel as a repository of all that is evil. We need not lament this phenomenon. We can combat it, and in combating it,
at the end of the day, as we always say with regard to our overall cause, that the pursuit of justice will, in fact, prevail. Tada.